listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
President Donald Trump was scheduled Wednesday to appear at the NATO summit in Brussels. Members of the Atlantic Alliance have been positioning themselves in anticipation of calls by President Trump for increased contributions to the organization's financing. This was the Secretary General of NATO, Jens Stoltenberg, at a press conference on Tuesday as he answered questions about the future of the organization.
Hello, Michael Birnbaum from the Washington Post. I wanted to ask, President Trump tweeted in the last hour, "The U.S. is spending many times more than any other country in order to protect them. Not fair to the U.S. taxpayer. On top of that, we lose $151 billion on trade with the European Union. Charge us big tariffs and barriers." What is the consequence for allied solidarity of linking trade and defense in the way President Trump is doing?
It confirms that there are different views among allies on different issues, including trade, but also climate change, the Iran nuclear deal, and other issues. I will leave, when it comes to trade, I will leave that to the European Union. When it comes to defense, that's for NATO. And when it comes to defense, my message is that we are actually now stepping up. European allies are stepping up, Canada is stepping up, and we're also doing more together, North America, United States, Canada, and Europe. And I'm absolutely certain that this summit will show that we are able to deliver on security, on defense, despite the disagreements we see on trade and other issues. And my one of my main responsibilities is to make sure that as long as the disagreements on trade remain unresolved, that we minimize the negative effects on the cooperation within NATO. We have been able to do that so far, And I'm confident that we'll once again be able to do that at the summit. Because we have a good story to tell. Yes, the burden sharing in the alliance is not fair. That's exactly why European allies and Canada are stepping up. The biggest increase in defense spending last year since the end of the Cold War. All allies have started to increase. More allies spend 2% of GDP on defense. And based on the national plans we agreed last year, we now estimate that European allies and Canada will add 266 billion extra for defense spending from now until 2024. So this is significant. This is really moving in the right direction. And therefore, I'm confident that it will also be reflected at the summit that we are moving in the right direction.
Süddeutsche Zeitung.
Daniel Brossel, Deutsche Zeitung here. Secretary General, you said you thanked President Trump for his leadership, and you said that it is clearly having an impact on the issue of the 2%. Aren't you worried that there might be a negative impact too, that the way President Trump communicates with member states might harm unity in NATO and might actually alienate the populations in some member countries from the alliance?
European allies and Canada should not increase defense spending to please the United States. They are increasing defense spending because it is in their own security interest to do so. That's the reason why they agreed to invest more in defense back in 2014. And that's the reason why they are investing more in defense now. All of them. I'm not saying that they all have spent enough, but I'm saying that we have a very good start with significant increase across Europe and Canada. Then increased defense spending across Canada and Europe also improves burden sharing, which is a good thing. But the reason to invest is not to please the United States. The reason to invest more in defense is because it's needed, because we live in a more unpredictable world. Let me also add that strong NATO is good for Europe, but it's also good for the United States. Two world wars and the Cold War taught us that we are stronger together than alone. And the only time NATO has invoked Article 5 was after an attack on the United States, 9/11, and hundreds of thousands of European soldiers and Canadian soldiers have served alongside US soldiers in Afghanistan. So NATO is a force multiplier for the United States. Allies have stood with the United States on battlefields from Korea to Afghanistan. And the US presence in Europe is, of course, good for European security, but it's also good for the United States. It's a way for the United States to have a platform to project military power to the Middle East and Africa. And European capabilities are also helping to strengthen the protection of the United States. So I believe that we at this summit can show that unity, resolve, solidarity in NATO is in the interest both of America, North America, and Europe, and therefore we will continue to deliver.
Okay, we go to Al Arabiya in the center here.
Nordin Fridi from Al Arabiya News Channel. Mr. Secretary General, 2 days before, the Tunisian security services has been deadly targeted by the terrorist organization. I would like to ask you about there should be in Tunisia a kind of lack of training, lack of equipment, proper equipment to fight terrorism. What NATO is providing already? What NATO can provide in the years ahead? And my second question linked to this one: the many terrorist groups acted in Tunisia came from Libya. And you received many times requests from the Libyan official to assist them in build defense institution. Given the crisis in Libya, did NATO manage to do any kind of job or organization or planning to help the Libyan, or still nothing because of the internal situation in this country? Thank you.
Well, we are providing some support to Tunisia already, but I expect that heads of state and government will agree at a package for defense capacity building for Tunisia at this summit. So then we can do more. And that's exactly addressing the issues you mentioned. It will be about helping them to fight terrorism. It's about border security. It's about intelligence. It's about countering IDs and other areas which are important addressing the terrorist threat. We strongly believe that working with partners as Tunisia is one of the best ways we can fight terrorism, because to train local forces, to enable local governments to stabilize their own countries is a much more viable strategy in the fight against terrorism than being forced to deploy our own troops in big combat operations. When it comes to Libya, we are, first of all, supporting the UN-led efforts to find a peaceful, negotiated solution to the crisis, to the conflict. But we are also ready to provide help with institution building, help them to build Ministry of Defense, other defense institutions. And we are working on that with the government of Libya now.
We'll take a couple of questions from the front row. We'll start with the gentleman first over there. Yeah.
News agency Interpress News, Georgia. Mr. Secretary General, before the summit, the NATO summit, Russian officials have constantly expressed their concerns over deepening relations between Georgia and NATO. Even yesterday, based on diplomatic sources inside NATO, the leading Russian news agency RIA Novosti reported that Georgia may join NATO without a membership action plan, and there are such discussions inside NATO. How would you assess such reports, and what tangible results could Georgia expect from the summit? And also, you have mentioned in your speech that the doors of NATO remain open for everyone who wants to join this organization. So if those doors are still open, why can't we enter, and when Georgia will be able to enter those open doors? Thank you.
I'm certain that the heads of state and government at the summit starting tomorrow will recognize the progress Georgia is making on reforms, on strengthening your defense and security institutions, and we will continue to provide support for Georgia, and we are also grateful for the support that Georgia provides to NATO missions and operations, not least in Afghanistan. So we think that Georgia is really making good progress. I'm not able to give you any specific timeline, but I think that the fact that both Montenegro has joined, and that we most likely will decide tomorrow to invite the former Yugoslav Republic of Macedonia to start accession talks, shows that NATO's door is open, and we will continue to support Georgia on its way towards membership. And we also expect that heads of state and government will agree that the decision we made in 2008 that Georgia will become member still stands.
Okay, we'll go over there.
I'm Mustafa Sarwar from Radio Free Europe. Thank you very much, Mr. Secretary General. As we speak, Saudi Arabia is hosting a two-day conference, peace conference on Afghanistan. How do you assess Saudi's role in the peace process in Afghanistan, and can these regional efforts eventually bring the encourage the Taliban to come to the negotiating table with the Afghan government? Thank you.
I think it is important to support an Afghan-led and Afghan-owned peace process. And that's exactly why NATO so strongly has welcomed the peace initiative taken by President Ghani. He invited Taliban without conditions to sit down and start peace negotiations. And he also launched a ceasefire in connection with the Eid holidays. We strongly underline that It is important with support from all countries in the region, but that support has to be to an Afghan-owned and Afghan-led peace process. The reason why NATO is in Afghanistan is to fight terrorism. To do so, we need a stable Afghanistan, and we will continue to be there. The purpose of NATO's military presence is to create the conditions for a peaceful negotiated solution. Taliban has to understand that they will not win on the battlefield, and they have to sit down and then talk with the Ghani government and find a political solution.
Agence France-Presse at the back. Yeah, over there. Thanks.
Bonjour, une question en français, s'il vous plaît. Le président Trump est assez imprévisible. Lors de sa rencontre avec le dirigeant nord-coréen, il a annulé sans prévenir personne un énorme exercice militaire qui était prévu avec la Corée du Sud. Est-ce que vous avez des craintes qu'avant de rencontrer le président Poutine, pour reprendre son expression et éviter les jeux de guerre, il ne fasse annuler l'exercice qui est prévu par l'OTAN en Norvège à l'automne? Et dans ce cas, quelles seraient les conséquences? Et une deuxième petite question, est-ce que vous partagez l'appel lancé par le président Donald Tusk tout à l'heure, à un peu plus de civilité dans les rapports entre les alliés? Est-ce qu'en invectivant les gens, on est encore en train de se considérer comme des alliés? Merci.
I welcome that President Trump will meet President Putin. That's full in line with NATO policies. NATO believes in what we call the dual-track approach to Russia, combining defense with dialogue. We need to be strong, we need to be firm, we need to be predictable, and NATO allies have invested more in defense, are increasing the readiness of forces, and we have battle groups in the eastern part of the alliance. So we show that we deliver on deterrence and defense. That is the best possible platform for political dialogue. Because we don't want a new Cold War, we don't want a new arms race. Russia's our neighbor, Russia's there to stay. And we need dialogue with Russia on many different levels to strive for a better relationship with Russia. But even without a better relationship, it is important to talk to Russia, to manage a difficult relationship, to avoid risks, miscalculations, misunderstandings, incidents and accidents. So with high tensions, more military activity along our borders, it is actually even more important with dialogue, military lines of communications between NATO and Russia and NATO allies and Russia. Several NATO leaders have met President Putin. NATO, for 2 years, we were not able to convene what we call the NATO-Russia Council. But since 2016, we have been able to convene 7 meetings of the NATO-Russia Council, which is a platform for direct dialogue Russia-NATO allies. So I think it's absolutely the right thing that President Trump meets President Putin. I'm confident that this meeting is important because dialogue is important in times of high tensions. Any measures that can reduce tensions, we welcome. But of course, it is important that NATO stay united. And I welcome the fact that we will also be able to discuss with President Trump ahead of the meeting with President Putin during our dinner tomorrow night, where we have the opportunity to discuss NATO's relationship with Russia. Then, on the other question, as I have said many times during the last months, that yes, there are disagreements and different views. And I expect actually also honest and frank discussions during the summit. But I strongly believe that NATO can continue to be the cornerstone of transatlantic security despite those disagreements. Partly because we have been able to do that before. There has been disagreements between allies as long as this alliance has existed. Back to the Suez Crisis in the 1950s, or when France decided to leave the command structure in the 1960s, and NATO had to move from Paris to Brussels. Our headquarters had to move from Paris to Brussels, or the Iraq War in 2003. So it's nothing new that there are disagreements between NATO allies. And the history tells us that NATO has been able to overcome those disagreements again and again. The second reason why I believe that NATO will continue to be the cornerstone of Euro-Atlantic security is that it is in our interest to maintain NATO. It is good for Europe, but it's also good for North America. The fact that in Europe, you have European forces, you have European infrastructure, which are important not only for the protection of Europe, but also for the U.S. to project military power to the Middle East and Africa. And the fact that European forces, capabilities, are important also to help to strengthen the protection of the United States. So therefore, and the third reason why I believe that NATO will continue to show resolve and solidarity, bring North America and Europe together, is that that's exactly what we have been doing now for a long time. We have to remember that after President Trump took office, US has increased their military presence in Europe with more troops, more exercises, more investment in infrastructure, pre-positioned equipment. Funding for US presence in Europe has increased by 40% since Trump became president. So actions speak louder than words. Yes, there are disagreements. Yes, there will be some open and frank discussions. But when it comes to substance, NATO is delivering, and NATO is delivering that US, Canada, and Europe are working more closely together. And just yet another example of that is that today, Prime Minister Trudeau announced that Canada will stay in Latvia for 4 more years, leading the battle group there. So that's yet another example of how North America and Europe are working together.
Okay, we had the Financial Times just behind.
Thank you very much, Michael Peel, Financial Times. Could you give us the latest figures based on your new expenditure data on how many countries are expected to reach the 2% target by 2025? And secondly, having put these expenditure figures out today, are you not worried that you have Germany, which of course has been a prime target of President Trump, and yet there are no fewer than 11 allies, including 9 EU members, which were spending less as a percentage than Germany last year?
We released these figures because we always release them at this time of the year. So that's a kind of normal cyclus in NATO when it comes to publishing defense spending figures. Earlier this year, we released the aggregated number. Now we release estimates for 2018 for each individual ally. And you can see the different numbers in the press statement. We expect, as in 2014, when we made the decision, only 3 allies spent 2% of GDP on defense. This year, we expect 8 allies to do so: the United States, Estonia, Greece, the United Kingdom, Latvia, Poland, Lithuania, and Romania. You will see, if you look at the charts, that a couple of these countries, they are at, for instance, 1.98, meaning that they are not at this stage fully at 100. But if you read the footnote and the whole table, you will see that these countries, which are not 100% at 2, but at 1.98 or something like that, they have clearly committed that they will meet the 2% target over the year. So they will do something while that. So it's at 2% or extremely close to 2%, 8 allies. And these are the initial estimates. Normally, actually, they improve over the year for the whole alliance. So then I think I answered your first question, 8 allies, also from 3 to 8. But the total defense spending partly depends on how many countries reach 2%. But of course, it's also important what happens with the rest. And the thing is that all allies are increasing in real terms. When it comes to Germany, Germany is also increasing. After years of cutting defense spending, Germany has started to increase. And of course, what Germany does matters, because Germany is so big, the biggest European economy. Last year, they increased defense spending by close to 6% in real terms. This year, Germany will continue to increase defense spending in real terms. And Germany has plans to increase spending by 80% real increase in defense spending from 2014 to 2024, over a decade. So also Germany is really moving in the right direction. But of course, I expect Germany, as many other allies, to do more.
Okay, we'll go late in the front row.
Daniela Cvetković from Serbian National Television. First question is about the region, of course. The role of NATO in the Balkans is becoming more important regarding the progress of Macedonia toward the membership. So how will the policy and support of NATO to Serbia will change or develop when we get that new member of NATO in the region? And do you expect some changes in the superpowers' relations with our region after that Helsinki summit in a few days?
Serbia is a close and highly valued partner of NATO. I appreciate very much that we have been able to step up our cooperation with Serbia. The fact that I expect that NATO allies will invite Skopje to start accession talks will not change our relationship with Serbia. I don't expect that there will be any... I will not speculate about the outcome of the meeting in Helsinki, but I think that anyway, NATO will continue to work with the Western Balkans because we have a history there, we have a presence there, with our the presence in Belgrade, in Sarajevo, and of course KFOR, we have many members there, and we also have several partners there. So for instance, Serbia will host NATO's civil preparedness exercise this year in October in Serbia, and that just shows that NATO totally respects the decision of Serbia to not seek NATO membership. That's absolutely fine for us, but we very much appreciate that Serbia continue to work with NATO as a partner, and we are grateful for the cooperation with Serbia.
All set.
Dominika Ćosić, Polish Television, Telewizja Polska. I wanted to ask on American permanent presence military in Poland. Do you expect some decision on this during this summit? Thank you.
The United States and Canada, North America, have increased their presence in Europe, including in Poland. And we have to understand that against the background of the fact that after the end of the Cold War, since the early 1990s, there has been a significant decrease in military presence of Canada and the United States in Europe. The last U.S. Battle tank left Europe in 2013. Now the United States is back with a full armored brigade. So what we see now is a significant increase of military presence of US and Canada in Europe, including in Poland, partly through the battle group. We have four battle groups, one in three Baltic countries and one in Poland. And in Poland, it's led by the United States, but partly also through increased U.S. presence outside the battle group. And the thing is that these U.S. deployments are different places in Europe, but they are part of a rotational presence, exercises, rotational presence, also, for instance, in Poland and the Baltic countries. So We are not planning any new decisions on our posture, but we have increased the readiness of our forces. We have increased the presence of NATO forces in the eastern part of the alliance, including in Poland. And we will make decisions now at this summit to increase our ability to quickly reinforce if needed. So, of course, NATO's deterrence and defense is not only based on the troops we have deployed, but NATO deterrence and defense is also based on the fact that we can quickly move in more forces if needed. Before a conflict breaks out, we need to have credible deterrence. And we will make decisions now on military mobility, on the new command structure, which is about also moving forces quickly, and also what you call the readiness initiative, the 30 battalions, the 38 squadrons, and the 30 battleships that should be ready to be used within 30 days or less. So this is also important for Poland, but it's important for the whole of NATO.
Okay, we have one last question, and we'll go to the third row, lady over there.
Good afternoon. Jovana Đurišić, Montenegrin Daily Pobjeda. A few days ago, Montenegrin Parliament has made decision to send troops to KFOR mission in Kosovo, but Serbia calls this decision as an unfriendly gesture. How do you comment on this decision, and how NATO can stop or at least help in calming tensions between these countries caused by this decision? Thank you.
So I welcome that Montenegro is now a member of the alliance. I also welcome that Montenegro contributes to our mission in Kosovo. But I also welcome the close partnership with Serbia. And it's absolutely possible for NATO to have a close and good cooperation with Serbia, and then at the same time be present in the KFOR mission, and also, of course, NATO allies contributing to the KFOR mission. Then I am aware that there are challenges related to Kosovo, and therefore we support the Belgrade-Pristina dialogue to try to find a negotiated and solution to the disagreements and the challenges we see in the relationship between Pristina and Belgrade.
Many thanks. This concludes this press conference, but of course we'll see you tomorrow, bright and early. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. A Trumpian kind of view. It is an understatement to say Donald Trump is an unconventional and unorthodox political figure. His critics do have a point when they say Trump appears to be harsher with allies than with real or imagined enemies. Then there's the Middle East and Iran. Why is Trump so obsessed with Tehran? Crosstalking a Trumpian kind of view, I'm joined by my guest Peter Ford in London. He's a former British ambassador to Syria and Bahrain. In Washington, we have James Jatris. He's a former U.S. diplomat and former advisor to U.S. Senate Republican leadership. And in New York, we have Richard Murphy. He is a former U.S. career ambassador to Syria and currently an adjunct scholar at the Middle East Institute. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump in anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. James, let me go to you first in Washington, because you've rapidly become the Donald Trump Sherpa for me. I know you're a supporter of the president, and you have a great foreign policy expertise. So I want to see if we can kind of unpack a few things here. For example, I give President Trump kudos with North Korea. If something could happen there, it's very, very complicated. The parlay is going to be long and hard, but I think it took a lot of courage to engage that, unlike past administrations. In Europe, with his European allies through NATO, tough love there. I think he's doing absolutely the right things. You want to be protected. okay, if Russia is such a terrible threat, then why don't you pay for it, okay? It's pretty simple. But then the wrinkle comes in, James. I mean, the Middle East. I mean, the Trump administration has embraced Israel and Saudi Arabia much more than past administrations. Iran is again a target with the rhetoric and the planning and all of that. I don't see any rhyme or reason to it all. Is there a silver bullet for you to give me to make me understand it? Go ahead, James.
Well, let me draw an analogy to start with, Peter. People have noticed that Trump, since the day he took office, even before, has been under siege from people in the intelligence community. I think that's one reason why he handed the sun, the moon, and the stars to the Pentagon. He had to have somebody who was on his side. When we put it into the international context that you just raised, look, we've got clients, and I do call them clients of not satellites, in Europe and the Far East, like South Korea and Japan. I think he can afford to kick them around. But when we come to the Middle East and talk about Israel and Saudi Arabia, I don't think they're so much our clients as we're their client. Given the kind of influence the Israelis and the Saudis have in this town, it's not so easy to cross them. So I think he is proceeding much more carefully there. Just as he indulges the Pentagon, I think he's indulging those countries. But we're going to have to see now if he can turn the corner, especially if he can work out something with Mr. Putin on Syria with regard to essentially keeping the Israelis and the Iranians away from each other near the Golan Heights. We might have the beginning of something constructive in that region, but that's going to be a very tough road to hoe, I think.
Okay, that's interesting. Peter, weigh in on that, too, because I guess restate my first question, but in a much shorter version, is that Trump is showing flexibility in some areas here. But other areas, they seem far more rigid. How do you see it? I mean, particularly in the region of the Middle East and Iran. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I think the key to understanding Trump, and I say this with some humility, but I think it does help to see him as an America firster, first and foremost, meaning, to use a term I don't like much myself, isolationist, the opposite of interventionist. Let's recall, the term America first. The America First Committee tried to keep America out of World War II. Yeah, and it's in the same spirit, the spirit of John Quincy Adams, who advised against America going abroad in search of monsters to slay. This is the tradition to which Trump harks back and which appeals so much, I think, to middle America. And he seems to be consistent in that. And almost all his moves can be interpreted in that spirit, whether it's pulling back from Korea, pulling back from NATO's overreach in Eastern Europe. The Middle East is a little bit different, but we will maybe come back to that.
Yeah, we will come back to that. Okay, hey, Richard, considering what we just heard from James and Peter, and I think both of them would agree that, and I like how James put it, indulging the Pentagon. I mean, the Pentagon's got a lot of money right now, okay? But what is that money for? And a lot of people would say it is for possible or continued military interventions, which the president ran against during the campaign, and now we have massive arms sales to Saudi Arabia and Israel here, and there seems to be a lot of ambiguity about what the U.S. policy is vis-a-vis Syria. How do you untie all this? Go ahead, Richard.
I don't think Syria's situation is well understood or has been well understood for the past several years. We made a mistake, there's no other word for it, back in 2011, assuming that the regime was very fragile and about to be blown away. Now, it managed to survive, and then it was bolstered by Russian support and Iranian support in the following years. But that mistake colored Washington's attitudes that you'd heard about during Obama's time. Do not get involved in yet another Middle Eastern war.
I think, Richard, you're absolutely right, and that's exactly where I wanted to go here. James, I think, okay, all of us are kind of more or less on the same page here, but then how do you account for the bellicose attitude towards Iran? I think Richard's right. Donald Trump knows enough about history that he doesn't want to be a president that's brought down by a foreign war that he really doesn't want to get involved in. I mean, I'm sure he's old enough to know what happened to Lyndon Johnson, for example, or George Bush Jr. with Iraq. He doesn't want to have that around his collar. But James, you know, using sanctions to intimidate friends and foes not to import Iranian oil. I mean, again, you know, and you look at the American allies in the region, Saudi Arabia and Israel, which love to see some kind of regime change or instability. That's probably their first priority. I mean, this seems to kind of go counter what Trumpianism is all about when it goes to foreign policy. James.
Absolutely. Clearly, I think Peter is right. Absolutely. It's an America first policy. I wouldn't call it isolationism. I would simply call it a sovereigntist policy. However, there is one big fat exception, and that is the Middle East. We don't have an America first policy in the Middle East. We have a Saudi Arabia and Israel first policy in the Middle East. I don't know whether that represents where Mr. Trump really wants to go or whether it is, like I said, in analogy to the Pentagon, whether he's indulging the realities that exist so he can do something else. If he can get us out of Syria, I don't expect us to admit we made a mistake in Syria. Of course we did. A tragic, horrible mistake. But in politics, people don't admit mistakes. If he can slip us out of Syria somehow, the real question is, will he take the bait on what has to be the red line that Israel and Saudi Arabia want regime change in Iran? And if he goes down that road, it's the end of his presidency. He needs to understand that. He ends up as George W. Bush if he goes down that road, maybe a lot worse. I frankly don't think he's going to do that, but he certainly got a lot of people, both foreign and domestic, pushing him in that direction. And right now he's indulging them. The question is whether he will follow through with that. I hope he doesn't.
You know, Peter, one of the things I've noticed that is unique about this presidency, all tweeting aside, is that I think serious people and not just pundits that are partisan one way or another. I mean, I listen to Trump's speeches, particularly when he goes to the base, and there's just a heck of a lot of hyperbole, and it's kind of baked in for me. Okay, I'm trying to understand the basis of what he's saying because, well, most of what he talks about is himself, okay? That's the Trump way. But I just have to wonder, when you look at his foreign policy views, I see it, a lot of it as bluster, and I'm kind of agreeing with James here. The bark is really there, but there's not always the follow-up. I mean, with Syria, we really don't know what's going on there. They're not really saying very much because I think there's going to be a withdrawal. But, I mean, could we look at the bluster towards Iran as this kind of bluster to keep the Saudis and the Israelis happy? Go ahead, Peter.
Yes, I think it's primarily to keep the Israelis and the Israeli lobby in the U.S. happy. Because look at it this way. Trump has already got a lot of enemies back home. Just watch your news feed. He's got the security state on his back. He's got most everybody on his back. He cannot afford also to have the Israel lobby on his back. Hmm. So this, combined with the fact that he has family links with Israel, pushes him in the direction of being an Iran hawk. Now, this is scary. And if he gets dragged down that path, we may be in for a very bumpy ride indeed. But I'm not sure that his heart is in it. I sense that it's opportunistic and dictated by his standing domestically in the U.S. He can't have too many enemies at the same time. Mm.
You know, Richard, reflect upon that. I think that's quite fascinating because you can have all of the bluster you want against Iran, but it does keep the Israelis and the Saudis happy. And it's one issue he doesn't really want to deal with right now because of the litany of trade issues, NATO, North Korea, meeting with Putin. It's on the back burner for him policy-wise, not rhetorically. What do you think, Richard?
It's not on the back burner, Peter. He's got to keep his eye on that situation in the southwestern part of Syria, where the heat is high. The Iranians have been maneuvering around too near to the Golan Heights for Israeli comfort, and that could trigger a fight and a broader conflict, which none of us needs.
Well, Richard, who would be the trigger? Which country would be the trigger? Who's the proactive character that you're referring to?
Well, I mean, Israel has been striking using air power against what it has identified as Iranian targets in Israel.
And in Syria.
That's where it could go bad. But
okay,
all right. In Syria.
Gentlemen, but I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. It's a hard break. I have to go there. After a short break, we'll continue our discussion on Trump's foreign policy. Stay with RT.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Okay, James, let me go back to you in Washington. Right before we went to the break, Richard pointed out a possible flashpoint in Syria, the Iranians and the Golan. We have to remind our viewers that the Golan Heights is illegally occupied by Israel, and it's not Israeli territory, okay? It's actually part of Syria, and the international community recognizes that. But I'm glad that Richard brought that up, James. I mean, again, you know, if you look at kind of the proactive, and I don't want to use the word aggressive, but proactive stance that Trump has taken on so many positions around the globe. Again, we go back to the Middle East where he seems to be reactive. I mean, is Israel determining what the United States might and might not do in the region? Syria is a very good example. Go ahead.
Well, I think Richard is right to point out southwest Syria as the real most important dangerous flashpoint here, and that's where it really comes down to Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin. Can they work out something that diffuses that? In the aftermath of the American failure in Syria, and it really has been a failure, that we're not really in a position to broker any kind of de-escalation in that area. Hopefully, the Russians can. This points to a serious paradox in American policy. We have these so-called neoconservatives here who are the most militant interventionists, especially in the Middle East. They're also the most militantly anti-Russian and are just in a complete meltdown now over the prospect of this summit coming up. What's odd, of course, is that Israel and Mr. Netanyahu have a very good relationship with Russia and Mr. Putin. So there, I think there are things that can be done on the ground there from Moscow that the people here just are getting dealt out of the picture.
That's a really good point. Let me go to Peter on that. I mean, it's widely speculated. I know that the NATO allies are terrified of Trump meeting with Putin because he might make a deal over their heads. Okay, all right, fine. That's a topic for another day. But I mean, the issue of Syria is very interesting. And what James says, I think, makes a lot of sense. Something could be an arrangement, let's put it that way, to deal with Syria. But why, Peter, would Vladimir Putin trust Donald Trump after everything that has been said and done? I mean, Ash Carter, remember when there was a ceasefire agreement, everybody was on board, and then all of a sudden, oh, we accidentally attacked the Syrian army. Oops, we didn't mean it. Wow, I mean, that didn't cut any ice with me or anyone else that I know. So, Peter, even if some kind of arrangement could be made to de-escalate in Syria, could the Russians trust the Americans to come through? And we have to remember that Trump is under a lot of enormous pressure at home, because even talking to Vladimir Putin in the eyes of the neoconservatives is treason. Go ahead, Peter.
Well, I think the Americans don't have much to negotiate with in Syria. The boots on the ground are very limited in numbers. Effectively, they're just a tripwire. The pro-U.S. forces in the south are in the process of being rolled up. That only leaves the north, the Idlib area, which is dominated in terms of external support by Turkey, not the U.S. And I think we're also in danger of looking at the wrong flashpoint. It's not the Golan. The Golan, the Assad approaching towards the Golan, I believe, is a done deal. Read the smoke signals coming or not coming out of Jerusalem. You can see that the Israelis will acquiesce in a return to the status quo ante. And the Iranians will not move up close to the Golan. There's no reason why they should want to. But the real potential flashpoint is a return to a Duma-type situation. Remember, yeah. just back in April, we came close to World War III, you know. We were talking in those terms, and the same scenario could be reproduced at any moment, but most likely it will be reproduced when the moment comes for the siege of Idlib, which is some months down the track. But it's perfectly foreseeable that the same conditions will be produced, and I believe there will be another fake chemical attack, which will trigger a really dangerous crisis.
Yeah, well, that let me go to Richard. People that do that are actually desperate. And when people that do that kind of thing, they're on the losing side. That's why they do it. I want to stay with the Trump-Putin meeting. And let's talk about Syria. Is there a possible in your mind where some kind of rough outline could be agreed to, where everybody could be seen as a winner without giving away anything? I don't know if that's possible here, but I think that that's something that Trump would like to say. Look, we're quickly resolving the issue in Syria. He likes to win. That's how he'll look at it. And of course, that would be a segue to somehow starting the Russia-U.S. bilateral relationship again, because it's pretty much been deep-sixed. What do you think about that, Richard?
Well, I think Russian interests are parallel to American in the sense that Putin doesn't want to get really caught in the quicksands of Syrian politics.
I agree.
And so that gives something to work with. The really wild card is the Iranians. And there is unquestionably a strong, almost fanatical, I'll call it fanatical, element in Tehran that sees its mission is in spreading its authority, its influence over Iraq, Syria, Lebanon, Yemen to some extent. And that I don't know what Putin and Trump can agree on.
Okay, well, James, I mean, this is the ongoing argument I've had with Richard. I mean, again, if that fanatical element in Tehran, I mean, they're only fueled by foreign policy mistakes by the former colonial powers in the United States. They're the ones that help spread real or imagined Iranian influence throughout the region. I mean, look, for example, the horrendous, shameful activity that's happening in Yemen, and the whole world watches this. It's a disgrace to humanity, and that's all blamed on Iran. Well, Iran wasn't there until it all started happening, but timelines don't matter to these people. Go ahead, James.
I guess I would disagree a bit with Richard, although I defer to his superior knowledge in this area. It just seems to me that in a world that in an Islamic world that's 13% Shiite, that any fanaticism from Tehran would be a self-correcting problem, that they simply don't have that throw weight to really have that kind of dominance in the region. As far as Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin go, I think Mr. Putin is well aware that Donald Trump does not control the apparatus of his own government. Whereas Putin is master of his house, Trump really is not, and he has to proceed much more carefully. And can he give orders that he knows will be obeyed? And lastly, as far as the allies go, I think the one who has the most to fear is Theresa May. Here's somebody whose government is dissolving out from under her. We've got their fingerprints all, not only on the white helmets and the Duma attack, a false flag like Peter was referring to, the Skripal thing, and also the Steele dossier. Let's not forget that. I hope Mr. Putin hands Mr. Trump a real dossier about what they've been up to over there in the United Kingdom to try to subvert American interests.
You know, Peter, one of the things, I've done a number of programs on this, but, you know, I've had experts on talking about the interests of this country versus the interests of this one and geopolitics. And sometimes it just gets down to Trump having a memory. I remember how you supported Hillary Clinton. I remember the dossier. I remember MI6 meddling in the election, not the Russians. You know, it's really, and then those Ukrainian oligarchs that gave money to the Clinton Foundation. I mean, you could say that's a layer that's how Donald Trump sees foreign policies, that when he's slighted, he's got it written down on the back of an envelope. Check, that person's done. That person's done. I'm making light of this a little bit, but obviously there's personal issues that's how Trump views the world here. Go ahead, Peter.
I think two keys to understanding Trump. One is this so-called isolationism or nativism. The other is his narcissism. And his narcissism, in a way, is his redeeming feature because it makes him depart from the orthodox Washington consensus. But he's in constant conflict. He's like a Gulliver who is pinned down by the Washington consensus, by these myriad of little advisors around him. The only times he's really free are in the middle of the night, 3 a.m., when he can tweet and nobody can stop him, or when he's in a summit. When he's in a summit, again, this is one-on-one, especially when they keep advisors out of the chamber. These are the times when he can be Donald. I think Donald should be more Donald, okay. If anything.
You know, Richard, it's already been brought up in this program, and I think it's an important question, is that, you know, when Trump goes and he's at the NATO confab there, and then when he meets with Putin here, I mean, NATO doesn't like the public browbeating that Trump has given them over spending. The spending issue has been on the table for a long time. It's nothing really new. And with the Trump Putin meeting, I mean, when they look at Trump, again, I want to go back to the rhetoric. Is he just more words? Because, you know, they're going to think that, you know, the summit will pass and they don't go back to work. There'll be the summit with Putin. And then Trump goes back on the campaign trail, going to his rallies. I mean, is it just more for photo ops and just bluster? Because I can't see that he has really the power to make a deal with Putin, for example.
Well, let's say this. He's shown he has two interests in the Middle East, the so-called peace process, doing something to get the biggest deal in history between Israelis and Palestinians, and then the price of oil. So those two issues do capture his attention. Where he's going, he has unfortunately weakened confidence in American leadership in the Middle East problem by withdrawing from the agreement, the JCPOA agreement.
Agreed.
And that's, he's playing with a weaker hand, the nuclear agreement with Iran. Yeah.
Okay, one thing is very, I'm glad, we're going to wrap it up here. I'm glad that Richard brought up oil prices. The way it's going, gentlemen, Donald Trump trying to lower oil prices, he's been actually helping them to increase. And the Saudis, treats them so well, the Saudis have not returned the favor to try to equalize the price. We'll see where this is going to go here. That's all the time we have, gentlemen. Many thanks to my guests in Washington, New York, and in London. And thanks to our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, crosstalk.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.